In the Netflix series Russian Doll, a woman stares at herself in a bathroom mirror while her own birthday party rages outside. That image is the foundation of a story about identity and trauma and memory.
Russian Doll is anchored by a dynamic performance from Natasha Lyonne, who co-created the show with Leslie Headland and Amy Poehler.
So today we're diving into the complicated and tangled world of Russian Doll. Here with me and Stephen in the studio is Glenn Weldon of NPR's Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And in our fourth chair, we are always happy to be joined by Weekend Edition editor Barry Hardiman. Hi, Barry.
Hello.
It's always so good to have you. Before we get started, we should clarify that we waited a few weeks after this series dropped on Netflix to talk about it. And one of the reasons for that is that it's very hard to talk about the show without spoiling it. So we are going to spoil it. It is only 8 half-hour episodes, so, you know, go catch up with it. We liked it, so we recommend that you watch it and then come back and catch up with us if you don't want to be spoiled. So let's jump in. It is about Lyonne's character, Nadia, Natasha Lyonne's character, Nadia. She discovers that she dies over and over again and always winds up coming back to this same spot in time, standing in front of the mirror at her 36th birthday party. And when she leaves the bathroom, she sees the same sights and things like that at first, but then as she loops over and over and over again, it's clear that there's some kind of cumulative effect of all these loops and things start to warp a little bit. She meets somebody else who's having a similar problem. So I want to talk to Glenn first. Glenn, you and I were early watchers of this show. Mm-hmm. I already spoiled the fact that we all pretty much like it. What did you think of it, Glenn?
Yeah, I'd go above like. What did I think of American Fleabag? I loved American Fleabag. And I'm not saying that to kind of denigrate it in any way. Yeah. I love Fleabag. I love this. There's a lot in common. You have a central character who is ostensibly abrasive and not likable, but you fall madly in love with her very quickly. There is a resolution that is incredibly satisfying. Look, this thing gets off the starting block based on the charisma of Natasha Lyonne. It keeps going for me because of this conceit, but we have seen this conceit many, many, many times before. Groundhog Day, Edge of Tomorrow, Happy Death Day, Source Code, Run Lola Run, many episodes of Star Trek, many episodes of Buffy, many episodes of Angel. This thing gets to the finish line based on the strength of this writing. There is not a single scene that is not given room to breathe, that doesn't feel lived in, that has grace notes in a way that something this schematic, this based on some kind of lore, you don't expect that in American television. Yeah. You expect simply for somebody to explain something to somebody else, and every scene is given a chance to complicate and kind of feel rough around the edges in much the same way that the Lower East Side, even today, can feel a little rough around the edges. The presence of Burt Young, randomly, for example, later on in the series, to just give Burt Young a chance to be charming and to give the main character a chance to feel warmly toward Burt Young, the actor, and Burt Young, the character. I love everything out of the roommate's mouth. We'll talk about the roommates more.
Yeah.
You don't give Elizabeth Ashley a role and then just have her sit there and spout exposition. You allow Elizabeth Ashley to be Elizabeth Ashley in all her glory. I love the writing. I love the scene where we discover that they have to go down the fire escape and the roommate says, I have a fire escape?
Yeah.
That wouldn't happen normally, right? Because it would be first thought, best thought, let's get to the next scene. Everything is given room to breathe. I loved it.
Yeah. How about you, Barry? What'd you think?
I adored it. And for many of the same reasons, the engine is the engine. It is. There is nothing else driving it except itself and every move that the characters make. It is the epitome of showing and not telling in a way that, you know, there's literally no exposition. You are just meant to watch it. Her performance is so wonderful. And I would actually, one of the things I actually love about her in particular is you described her as abrasive and maybe not likable. I actually found her, there is a warmth that starts at the very beginning, a kind of, you know she is a caretaker in some places in her life. But it also goes to show you that caretakers, you can perform as a caretaker and actually not be taking care. And I don't mean even of herself. There's a kind of, what is warmth and what does it mean to perform actions for another person? Yeah. And where that comes from. I loved her partner in Loops is Alan, Charlie Barnett, who is so charming. And when he appears and says to her, you know, oh, it's okay, I die all the time, that connection of like, there's another human, I instantly burst into tears. I just, there were so many things about this that I just thought were so moving. It is efficient, it is moving, and it made me think about my own life and the way that I perform love to other people.
It's funny that you said Charlie Barnett is charming. charming because I completely agree with you. But it's funny because at the beginning, seems very inert and awkward. Mm-hmm. And then gradually you come to understand how he's encountering this experience very differently than she is, even though it has similarities. How did this hit you, Stephen?
Yeah, I actually thought that character was kind of a drip. And he's going on a very different journey than she is, but to the same place where they're in pursuit of interconnectedness and collaboration. And they have to learn to interact with people and sort out their own business. I really loved it. I had the experience watching it that I think a lot of people had, which is I just sat down. I was like, well, I'm going to watch an episode or two, and then I'll kind of do some other things and come back to it. And then you just hit that little play button on the corner of the screen over and over again. If it's possible to accelerate, then I was doing that. And that is such a real feat of storytelling. Now, this show for me starts on third base. You know, because it is drawing on so many pieces of art that I love. Glenn, you mentioned Edge of Tomorrow and Groundhog Day and Happy Death Day. I mean, these are all things that I adore. There are even little glimmers of Arrival, and glimmers of The Good Place. I mean, these are just all like all of those things are things I absolutely love. They are just orbiting around the star of that is my affection. Yeah. So I got a huge kick out of it. And I appreciated the fact that this show has already generated so much speculation about what its story means. And you can talk to people who are like, well, it's I mean, obviously it's referencing Greek myth. The title of the last episode refers to an escape from the labyrinth. There are a lot of different ideas and concepts that you can graft onto your experience watching this show to explain some of the mysteries that it leaves open-ended.
One of the things I really liked about it is that there are elements of the story that they could have taken a lot longer to unwind or to have her figure out. She figures out what's going on fairly quickly, which I very much appreciated, because what I don't like is to be way ahead of the character and to be sitting there just waiting for her to catch up. I think that can be a really emotionally unsatisfying place to be as a viewer. Whereas she pretty quickly, you know, there are these wonderful scenes early on, the first couple times that she finds herself back in her apartment, there's this really fantastic way that she kind of is looking at everybody like, what is going on? And she has that perplexed quality because she doesn't instantly get it, but she gets it fairly quickly, which means she then is kind of going around trying to solve this herself. And when she talks to Alan, to this Charlie Barnett character, you really get the sense that she's like, no, you got to help me because we got to figure it out. And that takes you back to how much I admire this performance from Natasha Lyonne. And this is not, I am not the first person to make this point. This is a point Alan Sepinwall has made. But she really seems here like an actress who sort of wasn't getting exactly the right project for herself and therefore helped create the right project for herself. She has been around a long time. She goes back to, you know, But I'm a Cheerleader. She's been around. She had a really rough go for a while where she was very sick a lot of the time. And she didn't disappear, but she had a kind of a dip in her career. And then she's been on Orange is the New Black. She's great in everything she's in my experience, but it hasn't been exactly the right thing. And this is exactly the right thing. She is so confident about who this woman is and her comfort in the world that this woman lives in, which is she's a New York kind of, she would describe herself, I think, almost as kind of like a New York dirtbag in a way. Like, she's in the best way. She's not a fancy person. She doesn't see herself as a fancy person, but she's really earthy and she's so funny. There's a sequence where she keeps falling down the stairs. It is repetitive, but it's also so funny because I think everybody has had that moment in life where you feel like, I can't get past this one thing.
Yep.
I keep screwing up this one thing, and I can't, even though I know that I have to get past this obstacle, I just keep, I prepare, I get ready, and then I fall on my face again, and I can't believe it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things I was reacting to is that, is exactly what you're saying. I think this actress knows who she is intimately. And in the old days, when you had an actor of a very singular kind of affect, the studio system would try to plug them in and have them play that over and over again in different roles, quote unquote, but they'd be themselves. And nowadays, if you have a very singular affect that doesn't fit in, you have to create the projects yourself mm-hmm. and place yourself in
them. And you can.
And you mm-hmm. can. And she knows that she's a cross between Andrew Dice Clay and mm-hmm. the girl from Brave. Mm-hmm. And so she gives
says that in the
She
that's
says
a line
that
in, the show,
and
yeah.
she gives herself this role. And this is why I think it just feels like such a match.
Also yeah. the details of that character, which are not just that she is this New York dirtbag and the smoking and I mean, never have I wanted to take up smoking again so badly. and the hair and the that coat with the shoulder. I mean, it's so good. She's so great looking. But it's also that she is this video game designer. She has a brain mm-hmm. that works mm-hmm. in a certain way. So, of course, she's going to get to
right.
the thing faster. Whereas Alan, who, you know, a drip, maybe a little bit, he's inert. He can't move. And so I love that you have this female character that is not just groundbreaking in terms of we're going to love her in spite of some of these like uncomfortable sex scenes where she's not treating herself that well. And, you know, but we're also going to see this video game that she made that everybody fell in love mm-hmm. with. I wanted to watch it again,
yeah.
not just to see all of the Easter eggs and grace notes, which I'm sure it rewards, but just to watch her be her.
Yeah.
We haven't yet talked about the creepy, creepy, creepy performance of Jeremy Bob,
yeah.
who looks so much like a young Jack Nicholson
sure.
in all the creepiest ways that mm-hmm. I actually
it's had the hairline.
I actually had to look at and around the mouth.
Mm-hmm. Explain who he's playing.
Punchable mouth.
The very punchable mouth. He is a guy that she hooks up with early on, and he kind of is interwoven into their stories more and more to where you start to see how she and Alan are connected to each mm-hmm. other. They're connected through him being awful. And he is such a very specific kind of D-bag in a way that you don't always necessarily see on shows like this. D-bags tend to be drawn a little bit more broadly than
yeah.
this guy.
Mm-hmm. You know, you talk about the specific kind of person that he is. I think one of the things that makes Nadia such a wonderful character is that I love the fact that I love seeing a prestige show where you can have a character who's incredibly interesting without the central question being, this person seems like a violent monster, or they can be interesting without being, you know, this cartoon of a killer or mm-hmm, or even really a victim in the traditional way. She's and I love the fact, as Barry mentioned, I love the fact that you have a portrait of a woman who is in gaming where it's not a story about her being trolled or, mm-hmm.
or
you know,
just a woman in gaming.
Exactly.
Right.
She just
right.
is. That's right. her because she has a really clever mind and all of that kind of stuff. And one of the things I have loved watching is people reacting to things like the way that she says cockroach.
Mm-hmm. I love
and
it.
there were a lot of people kind of in my Twitter feed saying, oh, you know, it's so funny how she says cockroach. And then other people saying, have you never met New York
yeah.
Jewish women
before? right.
Like
right.
she understands what world this woman comes out of and lives in, and it's so wonderful in that way.
One tiny point I want to make that I really loved about this is that she's entirely covered, this entire mm-hmm. thing. She's in this overcoat. She's in these, like, at the end, she's in this shirt with the kind of the, it's sort of the pirate shirt. Mm-hmm. and yet, she's incredibly sexy. There is explicit sex in it, but we never see her nude, mm-hmm. which a friend of mine pointed out that, you know, this is a prestige show. Again, a woman in gaming who's not a woman in gaming, a woman who's, like, out there and having good sex and bad sex and not nude mm-hmm. and is acting through these layers and layers of both herself and the clothing. I think it's a real feat.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the smartest thing this show does, and this show does many smart things, is that the penultimate episode is a resolution of sorts. Mm-hmm. And it is a very self-inward-facing resolution. Mm-hmm. It's about overcoming trauma and reconciling with the past and forgiving yourself. All inward stuff, self stuff. In that same episode, Alan calls her the most selfish person I've ever met. And you think that's the end. You think they've cracked it. And then the episode after that comes, the finale, mm-hmm. in which we find out that this has always been about empathy, about mm-hmm. making human connections, about recognizing the immediacy, the urgency of being present for other people, which is exactly the process of therapy, working on yourself,
yeah.
because then you can make a connection. Or as a very wise philosopher once put it, if you don't love yourself, how the hell are you going to love anybody else?
Yeah.
Leading to...
the love you make is equal to the
exactly,
love.
Exactly. Leading to the most satisfying ending of a series, closing image
ever.
Of a series that I have ever experienced.
Co-sign.
It is just... It works so well. It is just as a feat of cinematography and just logistics, it just works so good.
This is like a gorgeous short story by Muriel Spark. I've never seen anything with this kind of specificity in the way that it uses story to tell something about love and empathy. And that the celebration of the ending, I mean, I'm telling you, like, tears streaming down my face both times I watched it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is so finely detailed, and this is a show I'm going to watch again. And one of the reasons I want to watch it again is the number of, somebody mentioned Easter eggs, the rotting fruit that you see kind of throughout the show that you know is a hint, but how?
Yeah.
Just all of the multiverse stuff that, you know, breezing through it the first time, I know I have not unpacked my own intense fan theory that each fan of this show has.
Mm-hmm.
So I got such a huge kick out of it. I love that it feels completely contained in these eight episodes.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't necessarily feel like, oh man, they're just
didn't want more. I didn't want less.
They're going to drag me along like the people who complain about Lost,
right.
You know, are going to have to spend however many seasons of this show waiting for a resolution that may or may not come.
Yeah.
It's a contained show.
And compared to something, by the way, like Haunting of Hill House, which has a similar tale that it's telling about trauma and need, and was had no efficiency. And you know, now, I mean, compared to this, it's like you can tell your tale and it doesn't have to be blown up.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I want to tip my hat also to just briefly to a theory that was floated on Twitter by the critic Jason Zinnemann at the New York Times, who said that he thinks the show is a meditation on cultural guilt over Tompkins Square Park in New York, which became a homeless encampment at one point and was, also a center where there were a lot of kind of countercultural folks, and then there was a crackdown and it was very difficult. And then there were demonstrations. And when I first read it, I thought, this is a really interesting but probably weird theory. And then the people who made the show began to weigh in and certainly made it seem like he is onto something.
Mm. I love this so much.
Can I throw out a question which will suggest that I ascribe to a form of gender essentialism, which I do not. But let me put it this way. When I went to IMDb and I saw that the writer's room on the show is entirely made of women, I was not surprised.
Yeah.
I don't mean anything by that except that there's the fact that this is powered by emotional connections and that there is not a feeling of like loss. There's not a feeling of here's the lore, here's the game of it, here's the technical.
Here's the mystery, here's the reveal.
Here's the mystery. It's about connections, emotions. Ultimately, it's about empathy. It's got Elizabeth Ashley. I mean, there's so much in this that just felt not queer per se, but a feminine impulse. Is that sexist to say?
I understand what you're saying.
I
mean, I think, I understand what you're saying, and I agree with all your caveats. There are plenty of men who write beautifully about empathy and feeling and some of these same themes, but there are very few writers' rooms made up entirely of women.
In a show that's this devoted to this big sci-fi fantasy gimmick, you know, I feel the same way about Winona Earp. I haven't seen a show vibrate on this particular frequency before.
And I think when you talk about the things like Groundhog Day and other things that this reminds you of, this is one of the few that really reckons with when you're looping and looping and looping, other people are affected by these loops and other people are experiencing. If, for example, something bad happens in that loop, in her case, her dying, other people that know her, she realizes, are experiencing that again and again. Whereas Groundhog Day, for example, is completely uninterested.
Mm-hmm. It's about hooking up with Andy McDowell.
In the idea that somewhere in the idea of the universe is a woman who is now being taken advantage of and getting hurt potentially over and over and over again for the benefit of you getting what you want.
Right.
And so I think part of the empathy is just understanding that there are other people in the world besides her who are affected by all of this looping. It's not just to improve her or to affect her.
But I also think that there are right now, you know, Happy Death Day, but, you know, we haven't really talked about 12 Monkeys, which is another, I think, really interesting show that deals with not this sort of determinism of where you're going in the time loop. It's not one loop. It is a multiverse. And so there's something happening right now in television, I think, in terms of interconnectedness and the way that we experience time and how we, you know, and that show's written by a man. It's not exactly the same quality, but I do, I think culture is really sort of chewing over the idea of the multiverse in a way that, you know, Spider-Man even, you know, in a way that is kind of wonderful.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. Well, I hope that as many of you as possible will watch Russian Doll. It is on Netflix. It is 8 half-hour episodes. It makes a good 4-hour binge if you have that time. Come and tell us what you thought of it. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week. So come right back.
Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
President Trump made history the first time he met with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Now he's hoping to do it again as the two meet for their second summit.
He's looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to it. We've made tremendous progress.
Can Trump actually convince Kim to give up his nuclear weapons? Follow all the latest by subscribing to the NPR Politics Podcast.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
It is the most exhaustingest time of the year, the time when we launch NPR Music's The Austin 100. On Tuesday, March 5th, we will be dropping our 100-song playlist of discoveries from South by Southwest. This is something I work on every year. It takes weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks to put together. It will not be downloadable this year, but it will be a glorious mix of musical discoveries that you can stream on any number of streaming services. It's a really terrific mix. We're launching it on Tuesday, March 5th with All Songs Considered, a South by Southwest preview show with me, Bob, and Robin, in which we will be feeding you discoveries galore. So much music for you to fall in love with. And we are going to put that episode in the Pop Culture Happy Hour feed so you don't have to sully yourself by subscribing to All Songs Considered. So that's the Austin 100 from NPR Music. And I can't wait for everybody to hear it. You can go to npr.org/Austin100.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Miracle Workers is a show that just started on TBS. We're a couple episodes in as we tape this. It stars Steve Buscemi as God, Daniel Radcliffe and Geraldine Viswanathan as angels, and Karen Soney as a kind of high-powered executive of heaven, which is a giant corporation. God is checked out. The premise of the show is that the two characters played by Radcliffe and Viswanathan are trying to save the Earth by getting these two human beings who are very shy together. Look, we live in a post-Good Place universe, so this whole thing feels familiar. The second episode is markedly higher in quality than the first, but it's written by Simon Rich, who is a writer I really, really like. Now, is it as sweet as The Good Place? No. There's a lot more acid, but that's kind of why I think I'm reacting to it like I am. It's funny, it's smart, and look out for the performance by Karen Soney. Man, that guy is just firing on all cylinders. He is the secret weapon of the show. So that's Miracle Workers on TBS.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Barry Hardiman, what's making you happy this week?
Well, for me, it is the most wonderfulest time of the year, too, because it's the time of the year when we have random snow days, and also my kids are sick, and I'm living in the basement because there's some work going on upstairs. So it's a very small room with me and these small animals. So me, the chickens, the husband are all downstairs, and there's one television, just the one, because, you know, wouldn't want to go overboard. What is a person to do when you've already watched all the Great British Bake Offs, which is one of the only shows that I think a whole family can agree on, where they're not quite old enough for Brooklyn Nine-Nine? I look forward to that day, Stephen. What is the thing that will keep everybody happy while you bake? It's American Ninja Warrior, guys. First of all, these episodes, which I think maybe is part of the reason they're so great, I actually have no idea how long they are. They may be 3 hours. I really don't know. But it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. It is basically a series of people who have overcome something in their lives in order to do this totally ridiculous, absurd set of obstacles, which include, you know, the floating bridge where you have to run over these giant things that are moving, like some terrible thing, which is like doorknobs that spin, and you're just all biceps as you go up and over it, and then a thing where you literally have to jump up a ladder holding another thing. Like, I cannot describe to you how crazy it is that these humans do these things. There's the spirit of, it has the Great British Bake Off spirit of everyone is there to support the other. It's a competition, but I mean, like, barely, because people are, you know, at every commercial, they're changing into the other team's shirts. Everyone is there for each other. Check it out. It is so much fun. You can, you know, you can dip in and out. You know, you don't have to pause it if you have to go to the bathroom,
right,
or like,
sure,
go get the wine from upstairs or whatever, mm-hmm, because it's like you'll see another person doing that crazy feat or failing at it, or failing but winning in some other more heartfelt way.
Yeah.
So anyway, guys, I just love it. And for extra bonus credit, the Titan Games, which is hosted by Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, is another kind of version of that, which, you know, isn't quite as long, but it can really get you to, like, bedtime.
I love this. I think this is a great evolution in the life of Barry Hardiman. Thank you very much, Barry.
You're welcome.
So what is making me happy this week is that sometimes the passing of a legend allows you a moment to appreciate everything that they have done that you have loved. And this week, the director Stanley Donen died. He was 94. He directed a lot of different kinds of films. Some were not musicals, like Charade and Two for the Road. But he directed a lot of the most beloved MGM musicals of the 40s and 50s. His first film as a director was On the Town with Gene Kelly and Frank Sinatra and Ann Miller and Betty Garrett, which he directed, I believe, when he was 25. It's really impressive. If you go back and watch that film, that's the New York, New York, wonderful town. The Bronx is up and the battery's down. He directed Singing in the Rain. That's sort of what a lot of the tributes focused on. But he also directed Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, which is a terrible, monstrous story with a lot of great dance, a lot of great dancing in it. You know, he directed It's Always Fair Weather, in which Gene Kelly dances on roller skates. He directed Royal Wedding, in which Fred Astaire dances on the ceiling. He is such an important director in my processing of music and film and joy. It was so lovely to have an opportunity to look back on all the things that he did that are so fantastic. You can find a lot of these things. If you look up On the Town on YouTube, you can find that opening number with Frank Sinatra and Gene Kelly and Jules Munshin. And, you know, of course, Singing in the Rain. So what's not to like? So it was a great privilege this week to remember the work of Stanley Donen. And I encourage anybody to seek it out who is interested in that. And that doesn't even touch, you know, his great work with Audrey Hepburn and Charade and Funny Face and
The Oranges,
things like that. Great director, great artist, such a privilege. And that is making me very happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can find Glenn at G.H. Weldon. You can find Barry
at the basement.
Barry Hardiman. You can find our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. And our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the music you are bobbing your head to right now. Thanks so much to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks. And thanks to all of you for listening. For more of our writing and the lowdown on what's making us happy every week, please subscribe to our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. We will see you all right back here next week.